From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the reporter behind the third season of the Journal Sentinel's Unsolved podcast tells the story of a 21-year-old crime with no arrests.
Later, why you shouldn't be surprised if your ambitious diet and exercise resolutions didn't stick this month.
People are very motivated. They often make grand changes and expect great results in a short amount of time. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen. So we see resolutions tend to fade away within 4 to 6 weeks after the new year.
Contributor Gene Creighton takes on a hot topic for a cold day, the beginning of the universe.
And writer, cartoonist, and Milwaukee native Paul Noth channels his experience growing up with 8 siblings in his latest middle grade novel.
I grew up with this idea of, like, there's sort of a complicated group dynamic or sort of political palace intrigue going on among the siblings and who has power and who doesn't.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Alfred Kuntz was a Catholic priest, the pastor of a church called St. Michael in the rural south-central Wisconsin town of Dane. He served the community for years, but on March 4, 1998, he was found murdered in a violent fashion in the church complex. No one has been arrested or convicted for the crime.
The Kuntz murder is the backbone for the third season of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Unsolved series and podcast. Reporter Gina Barton joins us in the studio and says that more than 20 years later, the Kuntz case remains notorious in that small town.
It was notorious for a lot of reasons. The small town, the fact that a priest was murdered. So many people said to me, "Who kills a Catholic priest?" That was definitely part of the issue. Also, the level of violence that was inflicted on him. It was a very violent crime. And his body was found in the hallway of the parish school.
Well, and so that question, who kills a Catholic priest, you're right that Kuntz was kind of a contradictory figure. What were the inherent contradictions that kind of girded his life?
Father Kuntz was a really interesting character, and he was also really unusual in terms of Catholic priests at that time, which was 1998 when this murder occurred. He rejected the changes of Vatican II, which was a church meeting in the 60s that modernized the church. So he still said the Catholic Latin Mass, even though he really wasn't supposed to. He was very much a my way or the highway kind of guy, but yet he welcomed homeless people to come and he would give them money and things like that. He was very strict about the Ten Commandments, but after he died, the police talked to a couple of women who said they had had romantic relationships with him. So he was a very interesting character and also very polarizing. People either loved him or hated him.
And you said he rejected a lot of the changes of Vatican II, but if I understand correctly, initially he had kind of gone along with him. He was kind of a modern priest in the late 60s and early 70s in ways that some others weren't.
Correct. And that's one of the things I haven't been able to really figure out about him is why that change happened. But he went along with those changes and the modernization. And the St. Michael Church actually burned down in 1974. And he was in charge of rebuilding the church, and I've been there. It was exactly what you would think a modern church would have looked like in 1974. And then sometime after that, somewhere along the way, he just had a change of heart and decided, you know, this is putting away 2,000 years of history. It's really taking the sacredness out of the Mass to do it this modern way. And so then it's really interesting. He kind of rebelled by following stricter rules.
This was, as we said, a huge story in 1998, and many people were initially assigned to investigate it. So why has the case been so difficult to crack for so long?
There are so many reasons why the police have not been able to solve this case. One is just what we were talking about. Father Kuntz had a lot of people he was close to. But a lot of those people he was close to were kind of on the fringes of society. And so the people who were part of his life, the police think any one of them could have snapped at some point and killed him. A couple other issues they had. The sheriff told me they suffered from tunnel vision early on in this investigation. And what he meant by that was that the teacher who called 911 to report finding the body was really the focus of the investigation for many years. When you try to prove that the guy you think did it is the murderer, instead of looking at the facts objectively and trying to let the facts point you to the murderer, your investigation can go awry. Another issue is that when a case goes on for 20 years, you have many different detectives running the investigation. So there was one team of investigators for about the first 2 years, and over the past 20, there have been almost half a dozen detectives in charge of the case. There are 40 binders full of documents. No single person has actually read them all. So how do you come in, you know, 2 or 5 or 10 years later and get a handle on this case? It's been tough.
Well, and from what I gather, there, in addition to this teacher at the school, there are other people that other investigators were convinced committed the crime and still are convinced. It sounds like there are multiple camps who believe multiple things even after all these years.
That's one of the other really tough things about this case. And even if they do definitively come up with a suspect that they can take to trial, that could be a problem. There are so many characters in this story, and each of them has either a current or former Dane County sheriff's deputy or detective who thinks they did it. So if I'm a defense attorney and you're charging my guy, I bring in 3 other cops who say, well, yeah, my report says this and I really thought it was this other guy. How do you convict anybody?
Do you think the nature of life in this small village of Dane changed as a result of this? Or would you think that the people there thought of this as an aberration and a horrible one, but went on with the way things have always been in a small town like that?
One reason why I wanted to look into this case for season 3 of Unsolved is that people in that community and people who knew Father Coons, people who went to the church, police officers, 20 years later, everybody is still really affected by this crime and this murder. And it's a matter of not only their security kind of being taken away on that one day, but also Father Coons was a really charismatic guy, and he ran the school and the church in this very distinctive way. And when he died, all of that stopped. I interviewed the man who's the pastor there now. He's great. He's a young guy, went to UW-Madison, but he doesn't preach the Latin Mass anymore.
It sounds like Father Coons was as close to a celebrity as a place like Dane could have.
I think so. The former sheriff, who was sheriff back at the time that this happened, he said, you know, in a town of 1,000 people or less, a guy walking around with a Roman collar is going to be recognizable. He was something of a celebrity, or at least a very well-known individual.
Well, Gina Barton, thank you so much, and we'll be listening.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Gina Barton is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The first and second episodes of Unsolved, Season 3, are available now. You'll find a link at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now, and then our Fit for You segment sheds some light on why your New Year's diet plans might not have worked out. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Many of us made pledges or resolutions to exercise or eat healthier in the new year, and many of us, in this building anyway, were confronted with the nachos for sale in the lobby at lunchtime yesterday. It's not unusual for these kinds of resolutions to go by the wayside in the first weeks of the new year, but why is that, and how can we make better plans?
For this month's Fit for You, Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Becky Kirkenbush, a clinical dietitian in the Milwaukee area. Kirkenbush explains that people often set lofty but unrealistic goals, but there are ways to do better by yourself.
When it comes to nutrition, after the first of the year, people are very motivated. They often make grand changes and expect great results in a short amount of time. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen. So we see resolutions tend to fade away within 4 to 6 weeks after the new year.
Do you think that typical approach of making a grand sweeping change and wanting to get these results or changes quick is part of why it fails?
Correct. I do. I think that people go into these diets expecting a tremendous amount of weight loss with perhaps little effort or no activity in addition to nutrition changes. They don't have a support system. So without the prior preparation and putting some thought into it, the resolution can easily fail.
Right. And based on what you've observed, either through, you know, media trends that we all can see are accessible or through your work, what are some of the top fad or popular diets you've come across this past year? You know, when I think of things, I'm thinking like the ketogenic diet, keto, paleo, gluten-free.
Correct. So what I've seen that doesn't tend to work long term would, I think, number one, the past year has been the keto diet, a very high fat diet, very low carbohydrate, low protein. I think the low carbohydrate diet is still popular as well, low carb, high protein. Those have to be the main two. And then, like you had mentioned, gluten-free is still a popular approach. And I see people that do not have celiac disease and are not gluten sensitive or have a gluten allergy follow this diet. And it mainly, for them, it's because it cuts out a lot of food, which reduces their calorie intake. And that's where the weight loss stems from.
Right. So when it comes to the keto diet, what makes that unsustainable in the long run?
So it's usually unsustainable because it heavily restricts carbohydrates, which our brain and our muscles do need to function properly. Very high fats, and if you don't choose the healthier fats and you're focused just on, let's say, I can have bacon as much as I want, anytime I want, after a while that does set into food fatigue, where if you're only eating a set 10 foods, that can get a little boring or tiring. And then you're cutting out foods that you might really enjoy, and the temptation there can set you up for failure.
Right. And when it comes to keto, you know, I see people doing calorie charts, making their grocery lists, like you mentioned before, like extreme shifts in their habits and behavior. And going into something like this without the support system seems very, you know, overwhelming as well. Do you think that these kind of fad diets take advantage of such drastic change that people think it's going to make them more successful if there's more work into it?
Correct. I think with the fad diet, what happens is they take advantage of providing you the meal plan, providing you all these black and white guidelines, which at first people really want and are successful with. But then there's no long-term maintenance education. There's no long-term management or guidance. You know, what do I do when I have a setback? Is this the correct diet for me in the first place? You know, diets should be very individualized for the person, and that's what a registered dietitian can do, is to take a look at a person's past medical history, their current lifestyle, what they tolerate and can't tolerate in their diet, and then they kind of set up a meal plan based on that. One size does not fit all, and that's also why some of these fad diets fail.
So what do you think is a more sustainable way that we can approach changing our diets? You mentioned that people often don't have a support system. So what steps should be taken before, you know, you cook that first meal of a new way of living?
Sure. If you have the opportunity, I would try to reach out to a registered dietitian. Many hospitals or outpatient clinics have that resource available. We are the experts for nutrition. And also take advantage of any, if there are any nutrition-related or cooking classes. Oftentimes, success starts with, are you able to make your food at home? You know, the better you are at food preparation, meal planning, and then actually cooking, the more success you'll have. But I seem to find that if you tell your family, look, this is a healthy way of eating, this is not just a diet for myself, and diet has rather a negative connotation to it. So we like to say, this is a way of living. So an overall lifestyle change that has a better approach and long-term result.
Do you think in the age of the internet and with so much information at our fingertips, this has been a big disadvantage for, you know, the dietitian community nutrition-wise, because there's so much information overload that a novice is going to go out and perhaps get the wrong information?
I do. I think you have to be very careful with the news that is out there. You know, not everyone is in it for, you know, the well-being of the other person. There are obviously these diets are created to make money, to sell books, to sell products. So everyone's personal story about why this diet worked and that diet worked for me. But again, we all have individual needs, and it's much, much bigger than just what you are eating. It's stress. It's emotions. It's who is your support around you. Do you work? Do you work too much? So all of those are factors into how successful your meal plan will be.
So what kind of meal plan would you suggest for someone, granted they don't have any medical restrictions for food groups? What's a type of, you know, diet is having this connotation with us that perhaps
sure.
isn't the right way, but what's a good protocol to follow, I should say, rather?
So the Mediterranean diet is still one of the best meal plans there are out there. And I say meal plans because it also stresses enjoying real whole foods, maintaining an active lifestyle, enjoying meals with family and friends, and just taking time to eat without all of the outside distractions and stimulation that I think we've become accustomed to. So it's really enjoying your meals.
Which I think is an important part because, especially in American culture, so much social life revolves around food.
Correct. We eat if we're happy. We eat if we're sad. We have potlucks at work. Every celebration, there's a dessert of some sort. So, and that's okay to celebrate and to enjoy our food, but oftentimes we do it just too often and in too big a portion.
Now, when it comes to finding the right foods for Mediterranean diet, I imagine by default, this is straying away from the overly processed foods we're finding on our market shelves.
Right, correct. Mediterranean diet is eating primarily plant-based foods, but you don't have to be a vegetarian. It's just they focus on whole foods like fruit, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and nuts. You're replacing the saturated fats such as butter with healthy fats like olive oil and canola oil. You're reducing your use of salt. You're flavoring with foods like herbs and spices instead. You may have red meat, but they really suggest having it no more than a few times a month. So maybe you're reducing your red meat to once a week. Eating fish and poultry twice a week as a substitution, perhaps, for the red meat. Enjoying meals with family and friends. You have that conversation that slows you down, so you're not eating. You're not in front of the TV eating mindlessly when we tend to eat too much. And then getting plenty of exercise, because activity is important. And people think, well, I'm not going to go out and run 2 miles. But what they're talking about with exercise or activity is just being active every single day.
And do you have a suggestions for how many minutes or what kinds of activities, say someone who is stuck in an office setting on a very snowy day like today, where perhaps we're limited into what we can do?
Sure. So they do, there's a general recommendation of 30 to 60 minutes a day of activity, and that doesn't have to be all at one time. That can be broken up throughout the day. Like you said, if you're in an office, let's say you're sitting at your desk at a computer, you can set a reminder or an alert. Every 15 minutes, you need to get up, go get a drink of water. You know, hydration is also important for health. Skip the soda, the sugary coffee, and the energy drinks in favor of water. And you can certainly flavor that water to make it more interesting. You can also increase activity by, if you have a large building, you can go do some stairs. You can take an extra walk during your lunch hour. So there are lots of ways to increase activity. I think it's just we get into a rut and we just get so focused on work that we don't take the breaks that we are entitled to.
Right. And when it comes to that downtime from work, with work being stressful, if we're in a situation such as that, I think it makes our downtime perhaps even more exacerbated. But one thing that is always preached that I admit I need to work on is the factor of getting enough sleep. What does sleep do for our bodies?
Sleep is really important. If you don't get the proper amount of sleep, so the time of sleep, and then the proper quality of sleep, it really disrupts certain hormones that we use for our metabolism. And so without the sleep, we wake up tired. We rely then on caffeine. We then maybe need the afternoon sugar to keep us awake. So we make poor choices that then also include poor food choices. We also don't have the energy then to exercise if we're that tired from not sleeping well. So it really does go hand in hand. Good sleep, good nutrition, good activity really creates that healthy lifestyle.
What are some healthy habits we can start that will ideally become a daily part of someone's life? Say they're not ready to go out and buy new groceries strictly for the Mediterranean diet. What are some small few steps they can take to work towards that?
Sure. And I say having one goal or one new habit, do that for a couple weeks. Let that become more natural to you and then add on to that. Don't overhaul everything at once. So the first thing I tell people is, try to have a breakfast in the morning. Breakfast is literally breaking the fast from when you're sleeping. So like a car does not run well when it's on empty, our body also does not run well when it hasn't had food. So eating something within to a half hour or an hour of waking up is important. Also, I would say avoiding extreme hunger. So using a hunger scale where 0 would be extreme hunger, 9 to 10 would be uncomfortably stuffed or full. You want to eat before you're extremely hungry and then stop when you're satisfied at about a 5 or a 6. So that's what we call being really mindful of eating. Other healthy habits would be not skipping a meal, because when we skip a meal, it tends to lead us to overeat at the next meal or make very poor food choices because we're so hungry by that time.
What do you think needs to change in, I mean, we'll limit it to American culture for now, but what needs to change to make these goals a more sustainable and healthy way of attaining a new lifestyle? I mean, you know, we go on vacation, we experience the way other countries live, their active lifestyle, like you mentioned, the Mediterranean diet, walking, eating, making food, spending time with family. But it seems like in America, they're counting on making money every single new year based on these diets and these resolutions and the whole gym membership scheme. You know, what needs to change? Is it individuals or is it the way corporations are marketing health?
I think it's the combination of everything. I think the American culture is I want it now, and I want it fast, and I want big amounts of it. I want my money's worth. So I think the consumer is certainly having a part of that and driving what is provided to us by the manufacturers and the companies. I think that people need to educate themselves on what works and what does not work. There is no magic pill that helps us lose all this weight, and there is no magic diet that is perfect for every person. So, and I think the other thing is looking and understanding, you know, what's in the foods that we are purchasing, reading the food label. They redone the food labels to make them easier to read. So knowing what is in your food. Also, learning how to cook. And it doesn't have to be big, extravagant meals. Just learning how to prepare meals at home more so we're not inclined to going through the drive-thru. Also setting priorities. Is nutrition and healthy eating for your family important? It should be, but is it what you're giving the time to that it deserves? So taking a Sunday to make sure you buy the proper groceries, to go home, plan the meals or the snacks ahead of time for the week. And it seems like a daunting task, but there is a lot of great information out there on how to do that so you are successful and that you maintain it. Getting your kids involved so that they know what healthy eating should be. Unfortunately, we're raising children that maybe don't know how to cook. They don't know how to read a food label. They think that 20 ounces of soda is normal and something that they should be drinking every day. So I think it does start certainly with parents and families, but then it does, the education needs to be there, and the companies certainly have an obligation or responsibility to also have some transparency and to let you know what is in their food, how it's prepared, how it's manufactured, things like that.
Well, Becky, hopefully with the expanded options and with some of the tools you mentioned today, some people can, if anything, restart their resolutions, because it's not just for January, right?
Correct. And, you know, I always tell people it's not one meal that makes or breaks you, but it's what you do repeatedly over time. So even if you feel like you want to give up, just start the next day, try it again and again.
All right. Well, Becky Kirkenbush, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Becky Kirkenbush is a clinical dietitian, an advanced practice board certified specialist in gerontological nutrition, and a fellow of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for this month's Fit for You segment, and you can listen to our past segments at WUWM.com.
It is below zero again today in Milwaukee. It was a fair amount warmer than that when the universe was created, however, and that will have to make do for a segue as Lake Effect continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. In the beginning, the universe was created. This has made a lot of people very angry and has widely been regarded as a bad idea.
Well, Lake Effect astronomy contributor Gene Creighton disagrees with that sentiment from writer Douglas Adams in The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. In fact, she's been dedicating her current shows at UWM's Manfred Olson Planetarium to the beginning of said universe. She joins us in the studio now.
Hello, Gene. Keeping warm?
I'm doing my very best here.
Yeah, I know. We're sitting here shivering in this studio, but we're about to talk about something that should warm us all up, and that is when the universe was a hot babe.
That's right. Really hot and young.
This is a while ago, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Between 13.7, 13.8, but that's the time, a billion years ago. That's what we're talking about.
Well, it's a few billion between friends.
Yeah. So we like to think about how the universe came to be, because relatively recently, within the last 50 years or so, we're starting to get tools that we can do that.
So we assume that there was a Big Bang, that there was a single point that the universe was, and it became what
the
we are now.
The huge universe that we see now.
Right.
So when we say assume, I want to caution you with that word, because we have some evidence. And that is, if you take, there's other evidence, but I think what's most easy to grasp is that if you look at these distant galaxies from us, you can measure their speed, you can measure their distance. If you run time backward, how long would it have gotten them to get to their current position? You can estimate how old the universe must be.
So, yes, we do have evidence of that. And how far back can we see? I mean, you used a word that I really liked, which is that you are archaeologists of,
on steroids.
On steroids, yeah. And it's you're kind of archaeologists of time.
Right, because the beautiful thing about astronomy is light takes some time to travel to us. So if we're looking at something nearby, well, then we're looking at the recent past. If we're looking at something far, we're looking at something at the far past. So when you look at the moon, for example, you're seeing it as it was a second ago. When you're looking at the sun, you're seeing it as it was 8 minutes ago. When you look at the brightest star in the sky, Sirius, you're looking at about 9 or so years ago, as it was 9 years ago. But if you choose to look at really, really distant galaxies, or even young galaxies like quasars, even farther, you see the universe as it was at that time. You don't infer it because you can see it.
We're actually looking at that.
We're looking at the past.
Which is really kind of cool.
It is an amazing
idea.
It's
an amazing thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So how far back can we go? We can't get to that very first point, can
Oh,
we?
No. In my view, there are two important moments in that look back time. So for starters, the universe didn't always have stars. So it didn't always have things that glowed as brightly as stars do. And so far with the Hubble Space Telescope and with other ground-based observatories, we can't at this point see the very first stars. We can see pretty close, maybe when the universe was, say, 2 billion years old, a long time ago. However, we're hoping that when the James Webb telescope comes online, we'll be able, with that extra sensitivity that it'll buy us, we'll be able to see the very, very first stars and galaxies that were formed in the universe.
And about when is that?
That would be about a billion years.
Okay. So seeing back before that time is going to be tough because there's nothing to see, right? There's no light.
Well, there's nothing light from stars, right?
Right.
Okay. We can do better than that, not in the visible light. We can do better than that in what we call the cosmic microwave background, which is an awesome term. Cosmic just because it's everywhere in the universe. Microwave because it's visible in the microwave. And background means that everything is on top of that.
It's the foundation.
That's the foundation. Any other signal, any other thing that you see is the microwave background and that. Talk about cold. The microwave background is sitting at about 3 degrees above absolute zero.
And so what is absolute zero in Fahrenheit? That's like minus 240 something?
Yeah, it makes this like a walk in the park on the beach.
Yeah, in your bathing suit.
Exactly. Yeah. So in other words, there is no spot in the universe that's going to be cooler than that. That's a minimum. Now, what's great about the cosmic microwave background is that that's the radiation that was released when the universe was still very hot and relatively small. It became from opaque transparent. That meant that light could issue forth, could move forward through space. And a lot of the information from that early universe was imprinted on that radiation. So Nobel Prizes have been had analyzing that microwave background because it tells us a lot of the properties of the early universe, including the fact that yes, we see that background, the 3 degrees, but if you increase your contrast, you can see what's going to become the seeds of galaxies in the future.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So not only looking back, but you're looking at the future as you're looking back. You're looking at what is about.
What will become the future.
Right.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So when the background radiation went from opaque to transparent and allowed light to escape, that means that light existed before that. We just couldn't see it because
of
the background?
Yeah, it was entangled with matter. Okay. It couldn't go anywhere. It was constantly interacting with matter. And what ended up happening was that, I mean, the universe was as hot as the sun is today. But because of the expansion of the universe, that wavelength got stretched out, cheapened, you can think of it as, to microwaves. So it got what we call redshifted. So
that's why we can see it on telescopes that are looking at the microwave spectrum.
That's right.
Part of the spectrum.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So as we look at the early universe, what are some of the most exciting things that astronomers and cosmologists are looking at right now, given the information that we have and what's been analyzed already about the early universe?
I want to make this personal. I mean, I'll get to your question, but I want to make it personal because when I started as an undergraduate student, cosmology was very mathematical and theoretical, and your universe was just as good as mine, and we could talk about where various philosophical differences about how we imagine the universe, but there was no data. In the time that I have not been an undergraduate student anymore, which is now some 20-some years, 30, that has completely changed. And now there's actual data describing the universe. So I just wanted to point out that is a fundamental difference in how we approach the study of the universe.
And in a very short time.
In a
short
time.
Even in human terms,
a very short time. Yeah, never mind in stars terms.
Right.
Yeah. So one of the things that we're excited about is that we've figured out in the last, it's now 20 years, that the universe not only is expanding, but it's accelerating in its expansion. So I like to say that we don't want to solve all the problems because what are we going to leave for the next generation of astrophysicists? How are they going to make their livelihood? But one of the current problems is what makes the universe accelerate? It is counterintuitive. no matter how you think about it, most, even if you consider the metaphor of an explosion, which is probably not very accurate, but in any case, if you imagine something starting, expanding, our tendency is, well, things are going to peter out. They're going to slow down.
And eventually fall back in on themselves.
Possibly even as much as that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea of the Big Crunch was a very, I'd say it had a 50-50 chance when I was a graduate student, and the data became more and more overwhelming that the Big Crunch is probably not a thing, that the universe really is accelerating in its expansion. The universe's end is probably going to be dark and cold, which is not something we want to think about today. But in any case, the point is that we are unsure of what is the mechanism. Is it a quality of gravity? Is it the quality of space-time? Is there something altogether different? We don't know. And that's exciting, that you have some pieces to a puzzle and you're trying to whip them all together and see if you can make a consistent theory that matches the data.
And I assume that there's more data coming in all the time.
Yes.
So that can change as
that
well
can
as
change.
Something new gets thrown in the pot, to mix our metaphors.
Right.
And the soup becomes a stew, you know.
But there's also another thing that not only do we change the more data comes in, but also as time goes on, as we get more powerful computers, as we can use super colliders, there are other ways of approaching the problem. So if you have a big enough computer, sometimes you can run a model that 10 years ago, it would be impractical. You simply couldn't in your lifetime as a researcher. And we have these really powerful super colliders. You can't reach the extreme conditions of the early universe, but you can approach them more than you could in the past. So these three approaches of the data, the computer simulations, and the extreme environments we can make in these synchrotron, in the colliders, brings together more insights.
I wonder what it would be like if we finally ever get probably well past our lifetimes, but maybe not. Maybe
things
what happens,
change.
Things change, but you know that we actually do know how the universe was created.
Mm-hmm. Think about, it's not even been 100 years since we knew there were galaxies. And
wow.
Now we're studying clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies.
And we're looking back in time to almost the beginning.
Almost when they first formed.
Right.
Things can change pretty quickly.
Pretty fast. Well, we'll have lots to talk about.
That's right. I'm actually hoping that we're talking to a person, maybe a person who's thinking about a career in astrophysics who might have a brilliant idea that he or she can share with the rest of us.
Maybe in 20 or 30 years.
That's right.
Yeah.
We can get them started early.
Get them started now. Well, Jean, thank you so much for braving the elements, for coming down to talk with us, and we'll talk with you next month.
Thanks so much.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and a regular Lake Effect contributor. The Beginning of the Universe program at the planetarium is Friday nights through February 22nd.
And the answer is 42.
So if you now understand the beginnings of our universe a little better, what about how things might end?
Consider the black hole inadvertently unleashed in Milwaukee native Paul Noth's latest book for middle grade readers. We will talk with him in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM.
I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Who among us did not have one of those days in middle school when you wish the world would end? For Hap Conklin, that's actually a very real prospect. Conklin is the young, sometimes bearded character at the center of a series of middle grade novels by Milwaukee native Paul Noth.
The latest is called How to Properly Dispose of Planet Earth, and Noth, who is also a New Yorker cartoonist, joins us in the studio to give us a preview. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Well, and so for people who are just catching up with Hap Conklin, Remind us who he is.
Well, Hap is he starts off in the fifth grade in the first book, and he has a very sort of large and crazy family that drive him crazy. In book one, he gets the opportunity to improve his situation by selling one particularly despotic member of his family to a group of aliens. But he doesn't realize that it's sort of a package deal, and it ends up he ends up selling his whole family to the aliens, and he has to get them back.
And here in book two, he has gone on, I believe, to middle school at this point.
Yes,
right?
He's now in sixth grade. Things are going a little bit better for him. He's not as he doesn't feel quite as oppressed and frightened as he did in book one. He's a little more confident. Trouble starts when he meets a girl. Her name is Nev Everly, and he would really like for her to be his lab partner. only he is unable to speak in her presence. And he figures out a way that he could stop time in order to think of something clever and funny to say, and that would allow him to ask her to be his lab partner.
This is, of course, the dream of every sixth grade boy.
Exactly. Exactly. But
I am still trying to think of the right thing to say to the girl that I wanted to make jokes to in sixth grade.
Right, exactly. And he thinks if he just had a little bit more time, he would be able to think of that reply.
There's a great series of cartoons, by the way, along with that concept.
Right, where the way he has things planned and the way things actually turn out, a side-by-side comparison. Unfortunately, in the process of this, he accidentally opens a black hole when he tries to stop time, and now it's going to swallow his classroom and swallow the school, the Earth, the solar system, probably, unless he can figure out a way to stop the black hole.
And being able to do that involves the use of his faithful and sometimes not faithful lizard, Squeep.
Yes. Squeep the lizard has become a bigger and bigger part of the story. Hap isn't really sure if it's actually his lizard, because Squeep seems to have more of a life than Hap does and has a lot more going on. And so it's not so much his lizard as just a lizard that lives with him whenever it decides to live with him and shows up whenever it decides to show up.
I can't remember whether we covered this ground exactly, but you come from a relatively large family.
Yes.
How much of the very kind of complex relationship between the Conklin siblings and their father and their elders is taken or maybe exaggerated from what it was like with the Noth family experience?
It's I say it's not based on the Noth family, but I think it is based on the way it felt growing up in a family like that. I have two brothers and six sisters. We all lived on the east side in a four-bedroom house. And so there was this sense of, you know, there was a sense of, I had a sense of like, it's unusual. I had a great loyalty and love for my family, and we're all still very close. But I also had a feeling of being, you know, of never having anything be my own, of people constantly being around, of, you know, a desire to get free of all of them all the time. And also a little bit of feeling unusual and like an outcast because of the family situation.
Well, and the Conklins, they're always these kind of shifting alliances. And I imagine when you're in a family like that, you know, you're always taking advantage of whatever alliance you can with whoever you can in whatever the situation dictates.
Yes. I grew up with this idea of like there's sort of a complicated group dynamic or sort of political palace intrigue going on among the siblings and who has power and who doesn't. And I feel like that's without me even trying to, I can't, even when I just draw a picture, I just add a lot of characters naturally. I've noticed that with comic artists that sort of were only children or came from small families, there's a lot of solitude in their panels. And with me, I just, from the time I was a kid drawing pictures, I just filled the page up with people because that was my reality. That was sort of the experience growing up.
Hap Conklin is not Calvin.
No, he's not. He does not have to. He does not have to sort of invent a companion. He has like almost too many companions, is how he feels.
Well, and Hap's sister Alice turns out to wield this kind of immense power in the middle school where they both go to school, and you know, obviously exaggerated from a real life kind of experience. But I am not the youngest in my family, but I always kind of, you know, you talk about younger siblings going to school and having to deal with the specter of their older and more powerful siblings who have already been there.
Yes, that's definitely part of this book. And that does come from my experience. I think that's why I sort of picked up on that idea and it began to resonate with me. Alice in the first book, she sort of, you know, she steals everything that belongs to him. And that was a real feeling. And I think that might be even if you have just a couple siblings, there might be that sense, that memory of that. But I felt that way really strongly growing up, that I couldn't have anything that was mine. There was no particular sibling that Alice was based on. But I did have the feeling, especially of going into middle school and high school, of, you know, I had two older sisters who went before me. And there was a real sense of like, oh, that's their brother. In some ways, I realized that they were more impressive people than I thought they were, because, you know, my older sisters, Jeannie and Felicia, they had this reputation that I could almost sort of ride on their coattails. But there was a disadvantage to that, too, you know.
What are Noth get-togethers like today? I mean, there are clearly a lot of funny people in your family.
Yes, there are. There, you know, and I'm not one of the, and weirdly, I'm not one of them. Well, I have sort of a quiet sense of humor. And I like to draw everything down on a picture. And I wasn't, and people in my family, it tends to be, you know, who's the loudest and who's the quickest, you know, verbally. And so, you know, it's a lot of very, very, you know, smart, funny, clever people. So it's fun, but it's also there are still some of those complex dynamics going on that I mentioned earlier.
We talked a lot the last time, I think, about your cartooning, but I'm not sure I realized that fiction was initially your aim, right?
Yeah, well, it was in around the late high school and college. That's when I got into books, the kind of books with words and not just, you know, words and pictures. Books and especially science fiction. And then in college, I sort of gravitated towards that, and I was a writing major, and I wrote some very strange literary fiction before I got around to doing this. But the first thing that sort of worked for me was comedy writing and cartoons. Those are the first things I began to sell. Cartoons to the New Yorker and comedy writing for, you know, various places, and Conan O'Brien and other places since then. And so my initial goal, though, what I kind of fell in love with first was storytelling.
What's the transition back and forth between reaching kind of the older audience that you write for with The New Yorker, presumably, and the somewhat younger audience here been like? I mean, do those two things, do you see them bleed over in any ways?
Sometimes. I feel like they're very different, and the only thing really that's connecting them is my sensibility in my work and what I have to get things to my own. For both audiences, I just do what I think is funny. You know, and try to do, you know, have my own point of view come forward.
Thinking about your sister and your somewhat famous brother-in-law, when they put together material, they get kind of instant feedback on whether it is funny and whether it has had its desired effect. What is it like for you to put this stuff out in the world thinking it's funny to you, but not necessarily knowing that you've reached the people you're intending in the way you're intending?
Yeah, it's a slower feedback loop, or I guess a larger feedback loop, because it takes more time for me to find out if people like the ideas as much as I do. And I think what that's, you know, I think that I slowly build confidence in that, no, I like this. And sometimes I put it out there not knowing whether other people will like it, you know, and just like I have to really just trust my judgment as to whether or not they'll like it. And I think on one thing that's happened since the first book is I've been touring a lot more. I get questions from audiences of kids all the time.
Well, I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
What do you hear from them?
Well, I mean, the question I got every time was, where do you get your ideas? How do you become a writer? You know, and it was through answering that over and over again that I started to realize how much I rely on my notebooks and my sketchbooks to just capture everything so I remember it and then develop the ideas over time. So I always tell them that I don't actually remember writing the idea for How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. It was just one of my ideas in all these notebook ideas that I found one day. And I show them the page. I do a PowerPoint presentation for them, and I show them the particular page, and I show them all of the books that I carry around, And I recommend to them, especially the ones that are interested in doing creative things, that they carry around a book, just a bad idea book, I call it. I write bad idea on the front of a notebook, and I said, because it's just for you, and you don't have to, it frees you up, it allows you to be creative, and you can, you know, you can decide later whether who you want to share it with or whether you like it tomorrow. I think that's what's helped a lot. Like, in a way, the feedback I get is from myself tomorrow. You know, do I still like this? Is this still funny? And if it stays funny for me for a couple of days, or if it resonates with me the way that, you know, these stories do, you know, then I know that I'm onto something. Like this one, the second one, I feel like when I had the idea of talking to the girl being like something that could open a black hole and swallowing the universe, after that, the book came very quickly because I'm like, yeah, no, that's it. That's what it felt like, you know, when I was that age, you know.
Right. And there are times when you're that age and you actually do talk to a girl that you wish that a black hole
right.
would open up and swallow the universe.
Right. Exactly. I like that. I like taking
I remember being 23 and that happening.
Yeah. Just taking the feeling of it, taking the worst case scenario and just letting it happen, you know, is sort of the idea.
Nine siblings growing up. There's a lot of pressure to, I imagine, with that many people around in a four-bedroom space, get rid of a lot of things. And
yes.
The question is, do any of your earliest journals and notebooks still exist, or did they all go right after they were finished?
Unfortunately, none of them exist anymore. now and then I'll hear from, you know, and I think that's just bound to happen with that many kids. Despite my parents' best efforts to preserve things.
No refrigerator large enough in the world.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There's no refrigerator large enough, and you just have to assume that there's just going to be a certain amount of, like, you know, wear and tear on everything. We're not going to have, you know, a TV or a stereo that lasts very long. You know, it'll just be broken eventually. It's little kids running around, that type of thing. So
you can, but in the end, you know, 30 years, 35 years down the road, there's not evidence of Paul Noth's earliest drawings.
Not that I know of, unless any of my teachers are listening. Maybe some of them still have. That's my only hope.
Have you looked on eBay?
Yeah, right.
Well, give us a quick flash forward. What is the third book that we can look forward to?
The third book continues the science fair story, but one of the major problems that Hap faces is that people think he's dead. And in fact, some of them think he's a ghost when he tries to communicate with them. And so it's called How to Win the Science Fair When You're Dead. And he's in a difficult situation, but it also ties together both of the stories, the story that we deal with in the first book concerning his grandma and the aliens, and what we bring up in the second book concerning, you know, this girl and the black hole and all of that, and Squeak the Lizard.
Well, Paul Noth, I hope you'll come back and see us again then, but congratulations on book number 2.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great to be here.
Milwaukee native Paul Noth's latest middle grade novel is called How to Properly Dispose of Planet Earth. It is the second in a trilogy. The writer and cartoonist will talk about his writing Saturday at 2 at Boswell Book Company. You can see some of his drawings from the book and from The New Yorker at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's Cosmic Edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in. Stay warm in yet another day of the polar vortex, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air is next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.